So maybe we should get started. Yeah, so in this second part of the lecture, I would like to continue with a couple of examples first in the first hour. In particular, show some examples that are taken from industrial applications, such as a smart card-based electronic purse scheme and the biometric authentication system. And in the last lecture, I will then give a bit background on some general results for reasoning and for verification techniques, which are applicable in this context, but also more generally when using formal techniques to analyze systems. And I will also then, in the end, give a short tool demo. Hi, so firstly, I don't know, I had this, this exercise last time. Did anyone find out where the bug is in this protocol? This is the point where we stopped last time. So it's probably a bit too much to ask for. Anyway, I will try to point this out slowly. Okay, so what is the problem here? So firstly, recall the protocol. So there's a non-scan from the client to the server, the public key and the tag signed certificate, and then the server returns a signature including the session key and the non, and also a certificate by the trusted third party which binds this public key to his identity, and then in the last message the client sends the secret encrypted under the session key to the server. Now the problem is if you try to think about this in a manual way, and of course I'm arguing here how to use automated tool support analysis, but just for the ethical purposes one could try to find this in a manual way to learn from that. So firstly, this is the secret that is supposed to be communicated in a secure way. So the question is whether the adversary could get the secret. So one way of trying to think about this would be just to start with the secret and see what the adversary would have to do to obtain the secret. I mean, of course, this is just a heuristic approach, and what I'm going to say now is not really a proof method, but rather some ideas how one can find a bug if one is there. But it's not really a complete method to establish that no attack is there, if one doesn't find one. So okay, we have to look at the secret, and it's obviously encrypted under the session key. So in order to get the secret, because it's not otherwise communicated, one possibility would be to try to get hold of the session key for the adversary. There may be others, but this would be one strategy. Okay, so where does the session key appear otherwise? In fact, it appears up there, and this is there are two different symbols, as I explained yesterday, because here we have to we have to say explicitly how the client is supposed to extract the session key from this expression, and this may or may not actually be the same. That's the point, right? Which you always have to remember. So the next question is, can the adversary somehow get hold of the session key or modify the session key or insert its own session key? That would be one possibility to get to the secret. And there we see that, the session key is encrypted under the public, using the public key of the client. Or more specifically, as we can see here, this is maybe an advantage of this precise notation, which looks a bit confusing at first, maybe, but it helps to see at this point, this is of course supposed to be the public key of the client, but for the server, this is in fact just, you know, just the second argument of the first message. It may actually be the public key or it may not be. And here we see, okay, the second argument is itself not protected. There is in fact, of course, a self-signed certificate, but the question is what level of protection does this really provide? The answer is not necessarily so much. In this case, or to put it another way, what if the adversary now, starting here, tries to convince the server to use his own public key? If that was possible, so somehow the adversary was able to substitute his own public key here, and the server would not notice that, then the server would simply send back this, encrypted under the public key of the adversary, and this is just the signature, so the adversary can extract the content with the public key of the server, and then the adversary would have the session key. Yeah, and that, then the next question is, okay, would be, could the adversary send on this session to the client without the client knowing that something went wrong? And the answer would be yes. The adversary could simply encrypt this inner part, the signature, then using the public key of the client, which is publicly available, and then from then on the protocol would proceed as usual, only that the adversary would actually be in possession of the session key, and therefore, of course, be able at this point to decrypt the secret. And so the question is really, does the self-certificate, scientific offer protection in this respect? And the problem is, unfortunately, it does not, because here the adversary could simply insert its own signed certificate, and as long as the server does not know beforehand who the identity of, and what the identity of the client is supposed to be, and that's, of course, the situation. If they would know them, you know, each other from the start, then we might not even have the need for such a protocol to exchange the session key. So, yeah, so the problem is, so the attack would try to, you know, explain to you how you can, would be able to find it out yourself. It's now displayed here. I hope you can read it. The client starts out with sending the message as intended to the adversary. The adversary forwards the message, but by substituting the client's public key with the adversary's public key, and also substituting his own self-signed certificate. The server, it's not really the self-signed certificate, but there's the identity of C in there still. So even if the server would expect someone like C to communicate with him, he would not notice anything at that point. And also, of course, it would be prudent for A not to send his own real identity, because otherwise, you know, he would be busted afterwards. So anyway, S doesn't notice anything, but just takes the public key KA to encrypt the signature, and as I just explained, the adversary is then able to derive the session key and re-encrypt the signature under the public key of C, who will then not notice anything, but, you know, send back the secret encrypted under the session key, and then the adversary has the secret. Okay, then the second question is, how can we fix this? What would be a good approach to fix this? Any ideas on that one? So again, okay. So how can we? There could be several different solutions, but one possibility would be, So how can could one find this? One general strategy to avoid these kind of attacks are that, of course, to include additional conditions at the protocol participant where they somehow try to still make sure that everything is still fine, nothing unusual happens. So one thing one could try to do is to somehow include a condition here where the client would notice if the adversary did this kind of trick here. And if the adversary in fact substituted his own public key to the server in his last message. So how could we do this? This would somehow involve the server, I guess, because only the server knows what kind of public key you receive from the network. So the server needs to somehow tell the client what kind of key he used in order to encrypt the message that he sent out here. And if that's a key, then everything is fine. If it's another key, then something went wrong there. And so how do you do this in a secure way? And we already had a message in here, constructed by the server, protected by using the private key of the server, which is the signature here, and which the adversary is not assumed to be able to break up or to modify in any way. So, yeah, I don't know if anyone sees the idea now, but I mean, the idea is just to enter whatever key is received here and used for the encryption here, and also insert that within this signature. And then, if the client receives this message, and of course checks what's inside here in the signature, he may as well check what this public key is, and you can then notice whether this is in fact a key or whether this is some other key. And this is the idea here. So the only thing you really have to do is to include the key which was received earlier as the second argument of the first message, include this in the signature, and include a third condition here that the client checks that the third part of the signature here is in fact the client's own public key. And in that case, probably not so difficult to see that the attack which I previously demonstrated is not possible anymore, because if the adversary would try to do that, then we would have KA in here, and this would not be equal to KB. Even of course that these would be different, which is of course a precondition on distributing public and private keys there. That's of course not a proof that this is really secure, but as I can show using the demo at the end, this is actually the case. So you can then use this theorem prover to show that this is actually secure using the approach which I explained in the last lecture. Okay, so much for the exercise. Now I want to start with the promised example. So firstly, this electronic birth scheme. So this is the so-called Common Electronic Birth Specification. That's a specification developed by NIFA International and other companies that presumably cover 90% of the market share in electronic births. The idea is now to offer a scheme which should be globally interoperable, because one problem so far with the take-up of these electronic births is that they only work on a national level. So one really good advantage would be if I could take my electronic birth and use it wherever I go in abroad. But this doesn't work so far because every country has their own national scheme. And this is the goal of the specifications, to provide the framework for having a globally interoperable scheme. Generally, of course, just as a background remark on these smart card-based payment schemes, the goal here is that you want to be more secure than the usual credit card-based payment systems. With credit cards, of course, you have the problem that you use a certain information, in this case the credit card number, to authorize a transaction, and this information stays the same for every transaction, which means of course that whoever gets hold of the information And this doesn't really have to be a hacker on the internet. This can simply be the employee who you tell the number to on the phone. And that's a very trivial attack possibility. You can simply use the number and buy something for himself, right? And this happens, unfortunately, and this is not a good situation. And this does not happen with the smart card-based schemes, because there, this information used to authenticate a transaction is different for every transaction. So you cannot reuse it again. And the way that this information is provided, I mean, relies on the smart cards, which we've seen in the previous talk, and on the fact that smart cards can make use of cryptographic algorithms themselves. So for every transaction, the smart card with its own secret key stored on the card produces a certain transaction authorization data, which will then be used to actually perform the transaction. And this can not be reused on a future transaction. And this way it is much more secure than credit cards. Another point maybe about this global interoperability is that you want to design a scheme where the different participants in the scheme, such as the card issuer or the owners of the load machines and the merchants and so on, do not necessarily have to trust each other, because it's supposed to be globally interoperable. And if one company betrays the other company, and if one of them is sort of on the other side of the earth, there's often no possibility to sue the company. I mean, of course, you can try, but if you don't have access to the national legislature or the national courts, and there may be different laws, and they may not care about companies from other countries, then you have a problem. So it should ideally be designed in a way that the different participants don't have to trust each other, not even the companies, the different companies who may be involved. And so that's the starting point. Now, while there are different protocols within these specifications, and two of the main protocols we actually looked at, which is the purchase protocol, where you actually use the card in order to buy a good in the shop, and then of course you want to be able to recharge the card, which is done using a load protocol, where you can put your card into a load machine and have a certain amount of cash stored on the card. And this is what I'm going to present here. There are several variations on that, and the one I'm presenting here is the unlinked cash-based node transaction, which means that you put in your card in the machine, you put in some cash, and it's going to be loaded. And so it's not linked to maybe to your account or something. And in this way, it is probably more insecure than the other schemes, because anyone could try to load the card, and if someone if something goes wrong, then you cannot necessarily link the person who who did this load transaction to a certain bank account. But this is really there's no connection there. Although of course the cards are not anonymous, so that should be mentioned. And the overall security of the system really relies on the fact that they are not anonymous, and that after the transactions there's a post-transaction verification done to find out that there were no attempts to fraud to fraud the system. And in fact, if someone tries to use a card, then in order to trick the system, and this comes out, then the card will be disabled. And that's why the logging of the transaction data is really very important here, because the security of the system in the long run relies on the fact that you can find out if someone tried to break the system. And the reason for that is that, to start with, smart cards do have limitations in terms of security, because most smart cards used today do not have a direct user interface. So the user is not, the cardholder is not able to directly communicate with the card, because there is no display and no keyboard on the smart cards. I mean, such smart cards exist actually, but they are usually not used. And This means here the user has to trust the terminal that the communication which takes place is actually accurate, that whatever is shown on the display of the terminal is actually correct and so on. Therefore, we need this, to log this, this transaction data to make sure that nothing went wrong there, because there's an inherent limitation in terms of security at that point. And this protocol makes use of symmetric cryptography. That's the way it was designed. So, so now we want to look at the specification. So firstly, just to get an overview, this specification, in this case, is Room A, consists of firstly the physical architecture, so three components, namely in this case the card, the loading machine, which includes a load security application module, which could again be a card or something else that is tamper proof, and then the card issuer. And we also have a class diagram, which includes the same object, and also in this case a logging object. And we have the activity diagram which coordinates the flow of control between these three components. And in each case, we may use a state chart to specify the behavior of these components in the protocol. Okay, so now more detail. This is the physical structure. So the card, which is a smart card, this again includes the information to what extent an adversary could interfere with this node, and in the case of the smart card, we assume that the default adversary is not able to access the smart card. Actually, this morning also we saw some effects where people try to access smart card physically, but here we assume let's say the writers of the specifications assume that the smart card used here are so much up to date that currently the usual adversaries would not be able to break them. This this could of course change, but for the moment we assume they are secure. And we have some the software sitting on these different nodes. And then the corresponding class diagrams, so I don't want to actually explain all of these different attributes and methods in detail, but you can see already that this is significantly more complex protocol than, of course, the example which I showed earlier, which was the three-line protocol, and also more complex than the infamous Meade-Schroeder protocol and many other protocols which are often considered in the academic literature. And I think I find it quite interesting also now to try to apply these kind of methods which have been around for quite a long time now to actual industrial problems and see how far one actually gets this way, even with larger protocols. So this is the activity diagram. In this case, also not very interesting, just means again that the three components are iterated separately. And so now here we get into, this is now not what is the protocol written, not as state charts, but again as a sequence diagram. It's more readable than if you had to look at the three different components, each as a state chart, because here you get the link between the behaviors of the three components. The disadvantage is that here you only have one scenario. So in the state chart, I also had the error handling mechanisms included, and this you could in principle also include in the sequence diagram, but then it would get really complicated, and so it's better to only consider one scenario at a time. And this is the scenario where there's no error occurring, but the transaction runs through as planned. Each data element in detail, but just very roughly, the load with the L stem has an initialization message to the card saying, I am LDA, I want to store the amount NN on the smart card. Then the smart card responds by saying, I am the smart card set, and I send you my transaction counter AP and also a signature S1, which is defined below here, which binds the identity of the smart card and the identity of the ASIN as received over the connection, and the amount as it was received, and also the transaction count of the card. Binds that together using the secret, the symmetric key shared between the card and the card and the card issuer. So the card wants to communicate securely with the issuer through the ASIN, which cannot be trusted in itself. Because, as I said before, each of the participants doesn't necessarily trust the other participants. So in this case, the card wants to communicate with the issuer in a secure way through the ASIN. Then the ASIN proceeds by sending the load message to the card issuer, which again contains the identity of the card as received earlier, its own identity, the amount needs to be stored, the card transaction count as received earlier, the signature as received from the card, then another random number encrypted this time under the shared key, which is shared between the ASIN and the issuer, and another MAC, which is also defined down here, which again puts together all these different data values and signs it with the random number or the randomly generated key. And then then a hash value of these values. And another hash value which makes use of a different random value. So there's a lot of data spent exchange here, and it's quite complicated, so it's probably not difficult to see that it's not easy to find out just by looking at the protocol whether this is secure. And you can see this if you just look at this method with all this stuff in the message. And then of course the issuer continues by checking the signatures using the shared keys, sending the keys shared with the ASIN and also the card, and extracting the information stored in the signatures. And answers to the ASIN again by sending back another signature, again certifying the values received from the ASIN to make sure that these are really the correct values. And then if this signature is actually correct, the ASIN continues again to send a message to the card, which will contain the signature sent by the card issuer. The card will then check that the values the issuer receives them and sends them back are actually the ones that the card actually sent off to start with. So at this point, one would hope that there is a secure channel between the card and the issuer, because the card sends values to the issuer, receives back the values, and checks whether they are really the correct values. And then the card proceeds by sending to the ASIN another signature, which is now again signed by the key shared between the card and the issuer. If this is correct, the loading machine actually performs loads the card with that amount, and the last message to the issuer then contains the transaction and data which the issuer will then store with this logging object. And also the ASIN and the card store this information, while their own respective information on their logging object. So quite a complicated protocol. Now again the question would be, is this secure in every way that you wanted to ask, including the fact that the participants don't necessarily trust each other? And this is, would probably now be very difficult to find out, and just a short discussion beforehand before I say a little bit about the results we obtained here. I mentioned already these cards are supposed to be tamper resistant, But the communication link between the card and the loading machine and of course the card issuer are possibly vulnerable. So the load machine may communicate with the card issuer over internet connection, which may or may not be protected. But we don't make an assumption there, but we just want to assume that, or the assumption in the specifications are that these are possibly vulnerable. And this is such the adversary model which arises there, that the adversary can in fact attack the communication links between the three participants. Then one might also wonder what could be possible attack motivations. I mean, this is not really part of the formal security analysis, but just for background. Okay, of course, the card holder could try to charge the card without actually paying cash. The loan acquirer could try to keep the card holder's money, and the card issuer could try to demand money from the loan acquirer, which the loan acquirer didn't actually receive. And of course, these three may actually coincide or collude, meaning that maybe the card issuer is at the same time the loan acquirer, or an employee at the card issuer who wants to get all some money by attacking the protocol may also be a card holder at the same time. So you, if you worry about whether companies would actually attack each other, and you may think that this sounds a bit paranoid, and there are actually quite a couple of examples where this happened surprisingly. So there's one nice example in the book by Ross Anderson, where he talks about the metro system in London, which is divided up into different parts owned by different private companies. And he said that at one point in the past, they actually tried to betray each other. And the point is that when a passenger enters the metro network in the part of one private company and exits the network the part which belongs to another private company, then somehow the fare which was paid has to be distributed between the different companies on the way. And while of course then the companies, or what the companies apparently did was to somehow virtually route the passenger in a way that they would get the most money out of it. I mean, it sounds a bit stupid, you know, I mean, how would you want to betray another company in this way, but apparently this actually happened. And another example which I heard from someone was working on a pay TV, or a company who provided encryption schemes for pay TV, and he said that another company actually hired hackers to attack the scheme of yet another company and to publish the the exploit on the internet. So yeah, I mean the world is really a bad place. Something we learn from that. And if it's about money, then we better not trust too many people. Okay, I mentioned already there's no direct communication between the card and the card holder, because there could be manipulation also on the display, and you need this post-transaction settlement. Okay, so this is what in this presentation I now want to focus on then. So with respect to these logging messages, you then have to consider different kinds of security requirements. So three of them are explained informally on the slide. Of course, you again have to consider them formalized as first order logic formulas. And now I actually want to concentrate on the second of them, namely the load acquirer security, saying that the load acquirer has to pay a certain amount to the card issuer only if the load acquirer has received M from the card holder. And of course, the other way around, if you receive that money, then he actually has to pay. You have to sort of track this down within the specifications to find out how this is actually realized. And there's actually a quote within the specification document that a certain signature, which we saw on this sequence diagram, namely this MEC-MLN, that this provides a guarantee that the load acquirer actually owes the transaction amount to the card issuer. And here we see what, how this is actually constructed. Here RLN, RN is a symmetric key shared between the card issuer and the node acquirer. There's some stuff signed here, including the nodes, the node amount, which, and now this is supposed to prove that the node acquirer actually owes this money to the card issuer. This is described informally here, how you could verify that, and again you have to formalize that in first order logic. Now the problem is that this is actually not true in the statement, which is written in the specification, and because in fact the signature does not provide this intended security service. And now the question is, why is this the case? Any ideas on that? So I mean, of course, I cannot expect from you to quickly understand the protocol, which I briefly showed on a couple of slides ago. But more interestingly enough, the problem here doesn't have so much to do with the actual protocol. So the problem which it comes down here actually is it's contained on the slide, and it's simply that all this information is in fact protected cryptographically by signing the information, and it is protected using a symmetric key. Why symmetric? Because of course the card issuer wants to be able to verify the signature to see whether this is actually secure. Now, the amount of, as I said already, the guarantee should be between the node acquirer and the card issuer, and they don't necessarily trust each other. So, for example, the card issuer wants to have a proof against the node acquirer whenever they have to go to court, maybe, that the node acquirer got this money and owes the money to the card issuer. And this the signature should constitute the proof which the bank issuer is going to try to use against the node acquirer. And again, the signature is created using a key which is shared between the node acquirer and the card issuer. So now symmetric encryption schemes or signature schemes have, of course, the property that both owners of the key can use the key not only to verify the signature but also to create a signature themselves, and that's the problem, right? The card issuer could have constructed this signature himself, it does not constitute a proof against the node acquirer that the node acquirer owns any money at all, because the node acquirer can say to the bank issuer, you constructed the signature yourself. I don't owe you anything, and there's nothing the card issuer can do. And the other way around, of course, the card issuer can try to betray the node acquirer by actually constructing such a signature himself. So if you want to provide this kind of security guarantee, what was stated here in the specifications, then you don't want to use the symmetric signature scheme. So this is maybe the outcome of that. And as I explained it now, you could have realized that without actually analyzing the protocol, but in fact, the problem is that people didn't realize it, and the experience is that, in fact, it's very useful to analyze the protocol anyway, because you will find these kind of problems because you have to analyze the protocol, and even though you could have found them in any other way, as we can see, sometimes it doesn't happen. So it's really useful to apply this kind of analysis method. So yeah, again, as I already indicated, how can you fix this? Well, use an asymmetric key to sign the signature. Using this corrected specification, you can analyze this with the tool and then demonstrate that this is actually now secure. Okay, so this was the first example which I wanted to explain here. The second industrial application, which I want to explain in this lecture before we have a break quickly, is this is a biometric access control system. So this is analyzed at the moment in the context of a project which is performed together with 10 industrial and academic partners in Germany, and or the idea is, or the goal is more generally to now apply formal methods on real life industrial systems on a rather large and demanding scale, one could say. So, and this one of these case studies is in fact this biometric access control system, and the goal is now to verify this from the application level down to the processor level and everything in between, to verify all that formally and also with respect to security requirements. And so this is quite an ambitious project, and so I will now explain the part of this which is related to security. So firstly, the architecture of the system. You want to be able to enable users to access a certain resource by using biometric authentication. And the access could be to a room which is protected by a door, or could also be to log into a computer account which is also protected by a computer, and where there may be a BIOS sensor attached to the computer. And so this could happen by reading fingerprints or scanning the eye iris or in whatever way. So this is not specific to the specification. You want to use a smart card in order to store the biometric data which is supposed to correspond to the data that the user should have. So you could compare this to a PIN-based authentication system where you have smart card together with a PIN. What we want to do here now is to replace the PIN with the biometric data that the user carries with him, for example, his finger. The reason is, of course, that this is going to be more secure because a password can be easily written down somewhere and someone else can find it. That's the usual problem, and hopefully finger cannot so easily be lost. cannot so easily be forged either. Of course, there are still some problems there, but anyway, we assume here now that this works in a secure way. And we only want to make sure again that the communication channel which we want to set up in a secure way is again secure. So here we have the same situation that we have different components, and the communication links between the different components are vulnerable to start with. So you need some kind of cryptographic protocol again to protect the communication. And so here we have again the architectural specification. With a card which is inserted in the card terminal, and the host system which includes the access control system, including the different pieces of software that have to be used, and also a BIOS sensor where you actually put on your finger maybe, which is supposed to be scanned. And again, we have certain threats arising from the different connections in the system. So this works again the same way as I explained yesterday. And again, we have a sort of a class diagram where we define what kind of attributes and methods are supposed to be used in the system, and we can also write down the security requirements that the different pieces of data and the different methods are supposed to realize. One can start with considering what kind of workflow the system is supposed to realize. Again, I don't want to expand it in too much detail here, but this is pretty much as you would expect. The user inserts the card, then the protocol is started on the smart card. There is some protocol exchange between the smart card and the host system. Eventually, the user has to provide his biometric data using the biometric sensor. This data is then compared with the data which was retrieved from the smart card, And then the host system reaches an access decision depending on whether there is a sufficient degree of identity between the data stored on the smart card and the data derived from the biosensor. By the way, this is never 100% perfectly matched. You can only have some degree of, you can say like there should be 99% match and then it's okay. Or depending on whether you want to be as secure as possible or whether you want to be as usable as possible. This is the usual trade-off, because either way you may have false positives or false negatives. That's the situation today. So this is a protocol from very far away, at least the main part of the protocol, the main scenario. Again, there is a certain second scenario where something some certain error occurs, which I'm not going to mention here. And now to look at that in more detail, again, I cannot explain every single message, but just the different protocol parts. So firstly, there's a couple of messages exchanged between the smart card and the host system to set up a mutual authentication using the standard, more or less standard challenge and response scheme. So there's not really much to say here. Some random values are exchanged, encrypted under the shared keys. So something I have to mention here is KH is the key of the host system, and below here there is a session key exchanged between the card and the host system, and this is the attribute SKSC at the card, and this would actually be identical to what at the host system is stored on the attribute SKH. So these are actually have the same value, or they're supposed to have the same value if the protocol executes as expected. So this is done in authentication, and then exchanging the shared session key. And then the next part, after exchanging that, in this scenario we consider here, we assume that there was some kind of attack attempt by the adversary. So the adversary maybe tried to use a sort of artificially constructed finger, and there are things like that, based on rubber or something, and try to match that with this data stored on the smart card, where we may assume that he found the smart card somewhere or he stole the smart card. And for that purpose, or in order to prevent these kind of attacks, there is a misused counter stored on the smart card. And this is counted downwards, so it starts with a value of 3, and every time someone tries a trick like that, counted downwards, and if 0 is reached, the card will be disabled. And because it is in fact in principle possible to attack a biometric sensor in this way, it is actually security critical to have this kind of misuse counter. The security of the protocol relies on the secure functioning of this misuse counter. This will be important for this further discussion. Then the next is next step here, the reference template and the signature is sent from the card to the host system. And the host system then communicates with the biosensor in order to actually receive the biometric data from the user through the biosensor. And then the host sensor will, host system will actually compare the biodata and the reference template, and depending on whether a certain threshold is reached, the access will be granted or not. This is the general protocol, sketched very roughly. And now just to see the big picture, this would be sort of the UMA specification where everything is put together. Looks maybe complicated, but at least you have to, the point is of course that the complexity of the protocol doesn't go away just by using a certain notation. I mean, this would of course be nonsense, but you may think that, okay, this using this kind of notation, at least you still have an overview. I mean, you have the possibility to see all of that with one view, and then you can zoom into each of the views on the system whenever you want to see something in more detail. But this may be a matter of taste, whether you like this kind of presentation. Now again, okay, so firstly, we worry about, again, translating this to first-order logic. And something we have to realize here, or to worry about, is that in this case, the way the smart card is implemented here, it is actually the case that the smart card does not necessarily enforce the order of the messages in the protocol. So the smart card at each point of its execution can be called with, in principle, with any of the messages that occur in the protocol. So this may sound a bit surprising at first, so this is something which you would not expect maybe in other protocols, but this is just the way that the smart card is implemented in this case. And of course, well, firstly, you have to adjust the translation to the first order logic formulas to this situation, because the one I gave yesterday actually preserved the enforcement of the order of the messages. Because if we remember there, the second predicate which follows, well, if you have two links in the sequence diagram, or if you have two transitions in a state machine, this really works the same way. Assuming that the two transitions follow each other, or the links follow each other, then you can define the predicate. And previously, we included the predicate for the second transition as within the conclusion of the implication which formalizes the first transition. Thereby, we get this order, but now, since the order is not checked, we have to modify this, and now all of the predicates are simply put together in a conjunction, and they are not contained in the other implications. And this really does make a difference, as we will see. So we'll see in a couple of slides. So here, I don't want to expand this really, but I just wanted to show you that you can actually generate the TPTP input file to the automated theorem prover from this protocol. And I just put this down here so you can see how this would look like. Just very roughly, the initial part here, these are actually the axioms that are always generated and which formalize the general power of the adversary, so you can recombinate messages and so on. And there are certain equations which are supposed to hold, as I explained yesterday. Then here, this is still the same stuff. So you have, again, this recombination. And then the third part, this is now protocol specific, and this is derived from the protocol specification, namely saying that certain knowledge should be initially known to the adversary, or you also have to include a certain functional equation. So in the protocol, there are certain functions used, for example, that you can associate a key with an identity using this find key function. So these also have to be included from the UML specification in the first order logic formulas. And here you then have the initial knowledge of the adversary. Then finally, the actual formula which arises from the protocol in several parts. So here you see the implications which arise from the communication of the smart card with the attacker, and all of this is quantified over with a for all quantifier with over all the three variables. Then this is put together in a conjunction with the formula which formalizes the interaction between the host system and the attacker, and then just a very short formula is the interaction between the biosensor and the attacker, because there's only one exchange between the biosensor and the rest of the system. So this is really the very input data, input file to the theorem prover, and that's all there is. And Well, the first couple of dice were really just whatever you had to generate each time, and only the last three dice or so are really generated from the protocol. So this is actually quite a compact formalization here still, and and that's maybe why it works quite efficiently also. Now the question is, okay, is there a problem here as well? Again, it's an unfair question to ask for you, so I will try to explain this step by step what the problem could be here. And so I hinted at that in a way already, namely the point is that the security of the protocol relies on the secure functioning of this diffuse counter. That's the first point. The second point is that the smart card does not ensure or does not enforce the order of the messages as received by the smart card, and that's where the problem arises. Namely, here we assume that in fact there was a sort of attempt by an adversary to trick the BIOS sensor into accepting an artificially created biodata as valid. And therefore, the host system wants to tell the smart card, okay, something went wrong here, please decrease the misuse counter in order to be able to keep the number of possibilities bounded that this could take place. And this is done by sending a message from the host system to the smart card, and the smart card returns, in fact, the information that
I think that what I wanted to explain first before I come to this one. I'm getting a bit confused here now myself. Yeah. So there in fact I interesting. Anyway, so the point is there are two kinds of problems in this. I remember what I meant to say this. Okay, there are two kinds of problems in this protocol, and the first one is, I almost said it already. So the problem is simply that the smart card does not check the correct order of the messages. So the attack here is very simple. The attacker simply drops the message that is the message that is sent here and which is supposed to tell the smart card that the smart card should decrease the misuse counter. So if it sends three messages, this is why I got confused myself. The first message is just a message from the host system to the smart card, asking the smart card to send the current value of the misuse counter. And the message below here is then the message from the host system to the smart card, asking the smart card to now decrease the misuse counter. And this is nicely protected by MAC, so the whole system cannot be tricked by the adversary to set in some other value here as the current misuse counter, and then the whole system decreases the misuse counter and sends a new value to the card, asking the card to store this value now. But as I said already, the adversary can simply drop this message 11 here and can simply continue with the next message. And then the misuse counter will not be decreased here. And the attacker can again try to trick the BIOS sensor however many times you want to and eventually may be successful. So this is insecure. So how can we try to fix this? And you may notice already that there are two numbers missing in between here, 12 and 13. And the point is, the corrected or the hopefully corrected version of the protocol inserts the messages there, means what are these supposed to do? Well, they are supposed to check whether in fact the smart card decreased in this with counter. Okay, so we are aware of the fact that this message could be dropped and the smart card didn't in fact store the decreased value in the missiles counter. So we want to make sure that this actually happens by sending another message to the smart card and hopefully receive back the new missiles counter, which should equal the one that we hope it to be. Well, the question is there a problem still? And this is now almost even I would mention imagine. But okay, what I should again to understand the notation here, I should firstly say that, as I said already, STH, which is the actually equal to SKTH. So this is the symmetric key shared between the host system and the smart card. Firstly that, and then this SD-2 is also going to be equal to SD-2 prime, because SD-2 is simply the attribute of the smart card, and SD-2 prime is the current value which this misuse counter attribute is supposed to contain at that point. Maybe it's not so easy to see, so I will just explain it. The point now is that this very exchange is also vulnerable. So if the attacker lets through this message, the adversary may as well drop the message here, but then of course the host system now waits for an answer from the smart card. And this is supposed to be protected by the shared key, and it's supposed to contain the new misuse counter value. But unfortunately, since as I mentioned, STH is equal to STFKT, and STZ2 is going to be equal to STZ2'. And you can see here, this expression is sent earlier via the adversary through the card without being protected in any other way. So the adversary will still have this message and can simply send it back here to the old system. So unfortunately, while it was a good attempt to solve the mistake, but it doesn't work. Unfortunately, in this case, I cannot say that there's a corrected version which will prove correct, because that's still ongoing work anyway. So maybe there will be a couple of more mistakes coming up later. But the moral to learn from this is simply that there are systems in industrial development where you can actually find mistakes and where you can actually make a difference. Right? I mean, these guys who designed the protocol, and they know in principle what they're doing, but the thing is really, the security is really difficult, and so they are really, it's really useful to have some kind of automated checks which you can perform here. So before we make the break, I just want to mention a couple of other applications which we are currently working on. So something of a more general nature is trying to apply this approach to firstly the Java security architecture, and then more generally to security architectural patterns. And this I will say a bit more on the talk on Saturday in the Vodka workshop. And then there's also some work about how to realize the security design principles by Welser and Schroeder, which I mentioned earlier, to how to enforce them within the context of this approach. Then something else we're working on in this project, Verisoft, which I mentioned, is a telematic automobile emergency application in cooperation with the German car company. And in another project, we're working on setting up an electronic signature architecture for an insurance company. And also, very interestingly, we're currently helping a company in Munich who is currently developing another electronic birth scheme for the Munich Oktoberfest. So if one day you go to the Oktoberfest, maybe this year or whenever, then you will see people with smart cards running around, and you can be happy that these were verified by our group, so they can feel very secure, hopefully. And this is the sort of very applied stuff, and it's, you know, it's just funny that you can, that I will then be able to actually see a piece of, you know, existing thing that actually runs software which I looked at. So that's quite exciting for someone who usually just does academic research, right? And, anyway, so yeah, before having a short break, just to give a summary of the third lecture. So, well, what moral is to gain from this? Security really is difficult. It's not just that I told you that, but it's really the case. I mean, if you didn't know this already by attending the other lectures, then you know it now. And there are still security flaws in industrial developed and used systems. And interestingly, for this approach, these are flaws, or many of them, you can actually detect on the design level, so you don't have to go down to the source code. This is, of course, also an interesting approach, which Thomas presented yesterday, which we're also interested in, but the point is, the more flaws you can find on the design level, the less trouble you have later when you may have to change your actual code. And it's also, well, because the models are, the design models are more abstract than the actual code, it's just easier and more efficient to apply, to try to apply the analysis methods there already. Okay, and well, there are some tools which, as I said already, I would like to present at the end of the next lecture, after I present some general results and reasoning techniques. So, are there any questions at this point? If not, then I would suggest having a short break. So I was again going to suggest 5 minutes, but the answer is probably 10 minutes again, I suppose. So, okay, we'll come back in 10 minutes then.